Hi, everyone. Welcome to November 30th and the last episode of our Grail series. Today, we explore Guinevere and we'll round out this series. I hope this has been a good series for you. This series has taught me so much. I can't even tell you. It feels like I'm going through some kind of alchemical quickening of my own, especially in the month of November. So this material does its work on us, and that is the power of myth. That is the power of story. It gets in there, and then it does its work, and then we're like, okay, I'm holding on. I'm opening up. I'm seeing things more clearly. And I shared, you know, some very personal anecdotes last time with you when we explored Ragnell, and I only have more to add today because this material is powerful and this exploration is powerful. It seems like that the podcast, I've always been about story. I've always been about exploring myth and the depth psychological perspectives. But it seems now, you know, that it's almost reinventing or reimagining itself, that we're always tying back even those themes to the imagination, to the transurfing material, to the emotional intelligence work that we've been doing. And that's really exciting to me because it's obviously the lens through which I'm seeing my life now. And obviously, if you're following along on the podcast, that is of interest to you too. I see everything through that lens now, and it's really changing how I see how I live my life. And we are meant to thrive. I don't just say that with a glib hopefulness. I see now with the work that we're doing together that it's assured. It is assured. And I have more to say on that topic. I've already thought about what December is going to be. And not saying that I have all the answers, but I'm discovering a deep clarity that I've never had before about how vibration and emotional intelligence and the heart's desires, how all of that is working together. And clearly the Grail series has illuminated that for me as well. So with that introduction, I hope you're doing well. And the moon is now in its waning phase. It was full just a few days ago. And the new cold moon will be around December 12th. And if you want a provocative, interesting, edgy gift for yourself or others in the new year, remember to order the calendar Radical Being 2024. It's going to be all about this kind of exploration and pushing the boundaries into the unknown and holding ourselves accountable for our thinking and feeling vibration and embracing beautiful, beautiful lives. Rich, abundant, beautiful in all areas. And that I can already tell you is what my 2024 is about because it's what my today is about. And that's a great calendar. It's a great gift. It's easy to wrap. And you can find it at lorigreen.net. I will also put another link in the show notes if you want to follow that thread. Guinevere is a really interesting character, and most of us have probably heard of her. She is Arthur's queen. And I'll read a little bit from this Anna Marie Ferguson, Legends of Arthurian, Keeper of the Words text. And she has a nice summation of Guinevere. She says, she was the daughter of Leodegan, a valuable and trusted friend to Arthur in the early days of his reign. It was during a long visit to Leodegan that Arthur first laid eyes upon the young woman. The slender beauty was known as Gwynfar to the Welsh, meaning white phantom, and indeed she had a complexion of cream and a grace of a swan. Arthur had made his choice, though Merlin disapproved and warned that Guinevere would bring him much sorrow. In some versions of the Arthurian saga, Guinevere is seen as a tragic figure. In others, she is blamed for the failure of Arthur's vision. Her affair with Lancelot was said to have caused a division among the knights of the Round Table. Since she was the wife of the High King, Guinevere's relationship with Arthur's best friend was considered not only adultery, but also an act of high treason, punishable by death. Although Arthur tried to overlook this indiscretion, the people and the new ways demanded justice. Lancelot would have to oppose the king and break the fellowship to save his love. This rather harsh treatment of Guinevere may be the result of interpretations by Christian chroniclers of medieval society. In reality, Guinevere's taking of lovers would not have been considered such a dire sin. The land was in a state of religious transition, a time when Celtic pre-Christian and Christian values overlapped. The old ways gave the queen complete equality with all the same rights and powers as the king. The Celtic queen was involved in all aspects of rule, including war. What the warrior queens may have lacked in brawn, they often made up in skill and strategic planning. Celtic queens were within their right to take lovers, as did their counterparts, the kings. I find that a really interesting perspective that, and it makes total sense because a Christian view of Guinevere would be very different than the more pagan view. And it makes such sense that we see this dichotomy with her. And so we'll be reading Guinevere through different lenses today. And we'll start, you know, sort of by pointing out that juxtaposition between who's interpreting her, that's how they're seeing her. But she is a very polarizing figure. And the Matthews take the perspective that they certainly acknowledge that about her character, and I'll read some passages here in just a moment. They acknowledge this polarity about her, but they are also offering the broader point that she is comfortable as a character and as a figure, as a myth figure, of claiming her desires and owning them. And in a society such as ours, in the U.S. culture, in a society for most women, most societies, I think, struggle with that aspect. Women are still very much seen as support staff, support roles, and we are not to be too demanding, too asking of justice, equal treatment, etc. And all of our female figures in the Grail series have exhibited a supreme sense of their own sovereignty. Guinevere is no different. She rounds out that. And what I'm coming to understand is we have these mythical figures and we can read them at the level of consciousness of what should be acceptable in society among equals. And then we can take it to the unity conscious level and say, my heart's desires, my desires are 100% appropriate on the level of the inner life. If that's where I'm accessing them, they are 100% appropriate and guaranteed. And that is the place that we go to have desire met. When we're looking for it externally, things become problematic. And so I think that's another way we can look at a figure like Guinevere is perhaps you could read some of the tensions in her stories as, is she coming from the inner to the outer or the outer to the inner? Is she in touch with her sovereignty in terms of her capital S self, or is she more in her human role? Because we can read her at all these different levels of consciousness. And so the Matthews, I would argue, are taking a more scholarly approach. They're more in that by me consciousness frame. And it's certainly illuminating and important. And I'll read those passages here now. But I'll extend that conversation more into the unity consciousness role, talking about desire, talking about the importance of that. And then we'll also talk today about new definitions that I've uncovered even in the last week, new to me and perhaps new to you, about acceptance. And then we'll just end by talking about the fact that Camelot is Guinevere's realm, just like it is Arthur's. And so she has a very rich and abundant material life. And we all deserve our own Camelots. We all deserve that. It matters that we approach it from the interiority and then release those desires from that space. That's the key. But we all should claim our own Camelots for ourselves, whatever that means to you, whatever that means to me. So the figure of Guinevere is very much about fruition, because we associate her, even if you've never read any of the Arthurian legends in depth, we all tend to know about her being Arthur's queen and the Queen of Camelot. So this is definitely a woman who has material blessing, and we have things we can learn from that. So I'll start by reading a few of the passages from the Matthews, Kathleen and John Matthews. One passage says, "Her polarized nature, beautiful woman yet faithless wife, respected queen who is yet insulted in court, is increasingly played upon by the later romancers, who take this as their warrant to portray Guinevere as a noble slut." That was a pretty powerful statement. So again, we see that dichotomy probably of whoever was writing about her. Were they writing about her from the pagan tradition or from the Christian tradition? You know, because these are all medieval stories. That's an important point. But again, we're going to extend this idea into the unity consciousness space. But let me read some more passages here from the Matthews. And in a way, I'll just add, it's kind of like the story of Eve. You know, she gets all the blame, all of it. And so it's kind of like that for me reading about Guinevere. We just see, oh yeah, let's just dump all that on this feminine figure. And I feel there's a collective rising up, and not, you know, I guess you could call it a pushing back against that, but I don't even want to say it that way, just an illumination that the feminine is so much larger than that. And just the wattage of her radiance is just silencing all of the bullshit. And I choose that word very intentionally. One sort of Celtic symbol that's often associated with Guinevere is that of the flower maid. And so the Matthews talk about that here. "The power of the flower maid is theirs, the power to energize and to transform dullness and lethargy into vibrant beauty, the power to find and fulfill one's inner nature, is the lesson of Guinevere." So she had this power of loveliness and vivacity that she brought to any occasion. And that is a beautiful thing. The maiden, the mother, the crone, sort of the three aspects of the goddess. Every feminine figure can occupy all of those. You know, that vivacity of the youth and the presence and life-giving nature and discernment of the mother figure, the wisdom of the crone. And I've always loved this. I think I've mentioned it before, that I think it's Clarissa Pinkola Estes often said that the maiden and the crone really like to be associated with each other. And the way I look at that is, in the crone years, there's like a new spring. There's a beautiful new spring that can flower in women. And I certainly feel it. And I'm so thankful for it. Like, I still feel like I'm 18 inside. I genuinely do. I know more. thankfully, than I did when I was 18. But I still feel that joy and that youth and that wonder and excitement. And I think that's a part of this maiden crone dance that is so beautiful. And so that's really evident in the character of Guinevere. And they often associate that with the quote unquote flower maid and her representing that. They go on to say, when the flower bride is cherished, the land is bounteous. When she is cheated or ignored, she retaliates by opening up the otherworldly gates for a challenger to beset her husband's realm. If a king is not careful, he can lose both queen and kingdom. So the Matthews are talking about more that pagan pre-Christian sensibility about Guinevere, that she had equal shots to call and she was going to be respected. And I think that's a beautiful sentiment. And there was no apology about that. That came with the Christian influence. And that is unfortunate. I don't resonate with that. And I love that, you know, there was such equality in that more pagan sense of kings and queens and her bounty and her and respecting her were essential to the flowering of the land as well. It wasn't this hierarchical system of king and then queen just as support role to him. So, you know, again, really understanding the lens of whoever the writer was of the particular story is really going to color how we see Guinevere, even though, admittedly, by all, she is a very complex character. But we all are, because there's so much that my ego has been in charge of when I think I'm only Lori Greene that I look back and I'm like, eh, you know, like, maybe that wasn't as skillful. And then there are the times when my capital self was more in my awareness, and those moments feel really amazing. What I am learning, and we will talk about this when I touch on acceptance here in just a moment, is that maintaining any kind of mental conflict over anything in the past is just wasted effort. It's wasted emotion. It's wasted vibrancy for what we're going for. That doesn't mean maybe that if amends need to be made or what have you, that that's not important. You know, I'm not saying that. But Esther Hicks' material and lectures have really pointed out to me how any conflict whatsoever that we're holding, even in a really subtle kind of low-grade way within our being, is not helping us. And that could be like, oh, I should have a higher credit score, or, oh, I should, you know, I really shouldn't have, you know, taken on this obligation, and I have an internal conflict about that, or whatever. I mean, there are a million ways it can show up. Let it go. Let the conflict go. She points out that absolutely everything in your human life is 100% and accepted by your divine self. Doesn't matter whatsoever. And to look at ourselves and others in that way and leave the justice to the divine is a beautiful way of removing conflict, just dropping it. And I like that idea that there's often a low-grade conflict just kind of humming along underneath the surface, even if we're doing a lot of tending to our thoughts and emotions. There's a lot of low-grade conflict, like just unease about whatever, the weather, you know, your weight on the scale, whatever, a million different things. To just let all that be embraced in acceptance. None of the conditions of our lives, not one, is an issue to the divine part of us. It's just not an issue. and to surrender to that beauty and that power and that sovereignty. That's really important. Reading again from the Matthews, chastity tests in literary tradition reflect the medieval preoccupation of keeping women in line. We see the operation of the good old double standard by which men may take mistresses, but women must remain faithful wives, whatever the provocation. Guinevere does not fit this bill. Like Igraine, her mother-in-law, Guinevere is a royal woman. The gift of the round table that comes as her dowry is a late hint at her regal nature, for the table is analogous to the land itself. Whoever partners her holds the land. With possession being 9/10 of the law, it is no wonder that so many would-be abductors come to remove her from Arthur. Significantly, it is the prerogative of the flower bride to make her own choice of partner, a choice which often breaks the rules of society, but which accords her with her deep inner nature. So what I'm getting about the scholarship regarding Guinevere is she is true to her inner nature. And that can be more from her sense as a woman in the high court. It can be perceived that way. And then I want to extend that now to unity consciousness and talk about these three levels of acceptance that have come to my attention. And acceptance and desire are really part of Guinevere's gifts to us. And we've touched on the desire bit, but let's extend that the desire of her in unity consciousness space would be being in touch with her heart's desires. And I can't really, from the texts, give examples of that. I'm just myself extending this metaphor for our work together. And so, again, I emphasize that no matter what character we're seeing, the importance of knowing that desire is important and sacred if we are approaching it from the inner realm to the outer, instead of the outer to the inner, that is appropriate, and it is our birthright. So I love embracing that sovereignty and that unapologetic claiming of that. That is also a gift of Guinevere. She is unapologetic in what she wants to claim, and we can all thrive in that space because she knows she deserves what she deserves. And again, where that is most fruitful is in the interiority and claiming it there and knowing that it matters. That really is such a gift of Guinevere's sensibility. She makes no apology. And so that brings this idea of acceptance to the conversation. And I've learned some really important things about acceptance in the last week. And I'd like to, at least at this moment, define it in three different ways. We've talked a lot in the podcast about, in our nightly disciplines with our mind, that when we see something coming at us in the external space, we accept it. That doesn't mean we want more of it. That doesn't mean we're giving it an okay or a pass. But it means I accept that this is happening and I'm not going to put up resistance or I'll just get more of that. So it's more a sense of acknowledgement. You accept that something's happening and then you turn within to say, am I throwing a pattern out that is coming back at me? You know, that sort of thing. So that has been a really important practice I've done around acceptance. The second one, though, is what I just talked about a moment ago, which I will repeat, and that is accepting that your divine self, this cannot be emphasized enough, your divine self doesn't have any issue with anything about your entire life, present moment, past, anything. It's like, you're cool. I so love you. I so see you. You are cherished. You are beloved. I have no issue. And any of that stuff is not an issue if you'll let me be in the driver's seat. None of it is an issue. There is a way. There is a way. There's a way to thrive and move through this in a first-class way. It's not like we just have to wait till the destination. Our journey can also be the first-class way. And that I have really picked up from Joseph Rodriguez's work on YouTube. So I really encourage you to check him out. He talks about that again and again, that the way we're awakening, we don't have to hardwire struggle into that either. And we'll talk about that in the future. We're going to talk about that in December. I've got some things to say about struggle. But the third acceptance then is a nuance that landed for me just a couple of days ago. And when we've talked about the heart's desires, and when we've talked about, you know, really embracing what is important and dear to us and knowing it's sacred and knowing that it already exists. If you're picking up on it in your inner world, it already exists. It's a done deal. And it's about having a vibrational match to that in your emotional state that then allows it to come into your material world. We've touched on this. We're going to go more deeply into this. But acceptance also has a third definition that relates to this that I just got the nuance of here a few days ago. And Neville Goddard's book, The Feeling is the Secret, is one that I've listened to and have read in. And there's a gentleman in the UK, I appreciated his work on this, that he just posted a few days ago. His channel is called Reborn with Michael Watson, and he's got some great stuff on there. But he had read The Feeling is a Secret many, many, many times, and he still felt that he was missing something about, okay, what is this feeling state that matters to bringing something into your material world, seeing it come to fruition so that it can be experienced? And I had the same question. Because yes, when I go to sleep or when I'm in a meditation, I can like have that wonderful dreamy feeling of living in that dream and enjoying the feeling of that. And yes, during the day, I keep my thoughts and emotions in a joyful space as much as possible, an accepting but joyful, you know, positive moving space with that. But I felt like at times trying to be too happy about things or feeling like I was faking an emotion if I, you know, or worrying that, oh, I'm not, you know, in the feeling, so this isn't going to happen, that kind of thing. I was having a little bit of push-pull conflict about that. And this YouTube really helped me see a new way to interpret what Neville Goddard was actually talking about. And I'm so grateful for Michael's work on this because I know he's right. And he had gone back through and listened to more lectures of Neville Goddard. And somebody had indeed asked Neville a similar sort of question about, quote unquote, the feeling and maintaining that. And he said the feeling is actually acceptance. There comes a point where you realize that, as Neville calls it, the law, or as we've sometimes called it, the quantum field. In other words, that neutral aspect of the way our world works that creates the mirror for us, that creates the conditions of the reflection that we experience in the external world. That facet of our lives is neutral. And we're always manifesting. We're never not creating. We haven't been doing it consciously, but we're always creating, and it's always throwing back the vibration and the beliefs that we've given it. And so to realize that the feeling is also when I've become wise to myself that I can do this intentionally and I've released the heart's desires, the feeling is also the acceptance that the law works for my chosen desires as well, and resting in the ease of that. And what he says in this YouTube video is, he says, if you were a god or a goddess, if you're in that nature of yourself, which we all are, you would be completely at ease about this. You wouldn't have to go around hyper and super happy in a weird way, because you'd be completely at ease about this. That's the feeling. It's really linked to acceptance that the law will work in joyful, gorgeous, beautiful ways as well. And you're at peace with that because it's been working your whole life. You just didn't know you were casting your own spell. And now you can. And it's not going to stop working now. Thank God. Because why would it? You know, and that's where doubt can kind of throw sand in the gears. But why would it stop now? Because it's something great? Well, that's a belief. So let that shit go. Okay, obviously we're having the explicit version today. So these three beautiful ways to think about acceptance. You know, that's really, really helpful. And when we think about a character like Guinevere, a lot of folks don't accept her. She's too much and she doesn't apologize for herself. And so that brings us into probably different ways that we've been hard on ourselves, where we have thought that spiritual practice, you know, means doing a bunch of stuff perfectly, all the rest of it. So I like this idea of opening up and relaxing and not apologizing about acceptance. And I really love these three ways of talking about that. So that is also one of her gifts. Going back to the six feminine psychic figures that the female often holds for us and in our psyche, in our psychic space, you know, the human mother, do you see any Guinevere-ian connections there in your life? The mother complex, do you see any of the characteristics we're talking about Guinevere there? You know, I would definitely say there's a lot of mother complex in the culture about, you know, you're either a virgin or a whore. And that's coming up in the Guinevere character a lot. The mother archetype, her bounty, her beauty, and her abundance. The fair maiden, is she an inspirex for another figure? Wife or partner? And then Sophia, the wisdom space. So these aspects that we're talking about with Guinevere, it's worth noting. Are there areas of desire and acceptance and fruition and apology and claiming my Camelot where I see that I'm having to release an old idea, or where someone else has projected an idea onto me that I don't want to carry anymore? And so now we liken what we're learning about Guinevere and what she represents back to the Maidens of the Well, which is, again, what predated all of the Arthurian legends. And we have those beautiful qualities of mystery and hospitality, abundance, and justice. And I think it's easy to see that the mystery of Guinevere is that she won't be pinned down either. And that is as it should be. She is defining herself. She is defining herself. And if we are wanting to put her or ourselves in some kind of box, that's our problem. She will not be defined. And I think that is a beautiful mystery that she brings to the conversation. Her abundance and her hospitality, she claims her Camelot. She does not apologize that she should have beautiful things, that she should have a court, that she should be respected. Now, not all of her stories go that way, you know, and so we can either look at that through the lens of who's writing that story, or we could say, you know, just like all of us, we do things from our egoic nature and our self nature. So there's that piece, that polarity, that duality. But in terms of her abundance and her hospitality, she is unapologetic about that. And in the interior realm, we don't need to be either. We don't need to skimp. We don't need to save. We don't need to ask a little. I know there's been a pattern in my life where I feel like I was asking for too much. And indeed, externally, that may be the case. Certainly as a child, I wasn't. You know, certainly as a child, I wasn't. And certainly at moments in my life as an adult, I haven't been asking for too much. But the trick is, if you know internally that you're not asking for too much, then it all flows. It all flows. We'll meet that conflict in the mirror world if we have conflict around that idea. And Guinevere simply does not. And so lastly, justice. She grants herself justice. She is her own sense of justice. And again, very unapologetically. Unapologetically. And that is because she claims it. And she doesn't let others identify her or what she's capable of. And again, when we link that to the interiority, we don't need to worry about that either. We accept that. That is the feeling of the wish fulfilled, to put that in Neville Goddard language. That is claiming that and knowing that the law works for us in beautiful ways, as well as ways that we haven't been aware that we were projecting out. So to conclude, I know I wanted to finish by talking way back from the beginning about Percival and the fact that he set out to find the Grail. And he stumbled on it one time and didn't know about the right questions to ask. And then he spent years later trying to rediscover it. And so I wanted to conclude the Grail stories now that we've spent all this time in the beautiful presence of the feminine. I wanted to end by returning to the legend itself that most of us are somewhat familiar with. And to know that the Grail is achieved. And what that means for us in the space of unity consciousness is you claim your birthright to have your heart's desires and experience them in the material world, to know yourself as divine. The most beautiful aspect, the most essential quality of defining all of ourselves as the Grail on the level of unity consciousness. You're the Grail, I'm the Grail, everybody is the Grail. Accessing our capital self nature. The beautiful thing about heart's desires is it makes you realize that about yourself, because you can't attain those heart's desires without stripping back the layers that are getting in your way. And guess what we keep finding? Pure gold, pure radiance, pure soul, pure spirit, vitality, vibrance, light, with the appreciation of the shadow and of the dark. It is wholeness. It is not perfection. It is wholeness. That is exciting. And so we're expanding our own identities about ourselves as the I am. The I am links to the Grail. They are the same thing. So to finish out the story of Percival, and to finish out our Grail series, I return to Anna Marie Ferguson's excerpt about Percival. So this will recap a bit of his story and then tell us how it all ends. Percival, or Pure Fool, spent his childhood in a remote part of Wales. In being so far from the court, his mother had hoped to shield him from the heroic songs and tales that would encourage him to take up a career in arms. Despite all her efforts, however, Percival encountered this foreign world when one afternoon he happened across some of Arthur's knights passing through the forest. Having never seen a knight before, Percival was dazzled by the sight and thought them to be angels. Much to his mother's dismay, Percival was determined to follow them to Camelot and become a knight of the Round Table. It broke her heart to think of the dangerous and violent life Percival had chosen, but in realizing nothing would dissuade her innocent and inquisitive son, she saw him off with the gift of a new homespun tunic and some words of advice. On arriving in Camelot, Percival promptly asked to be made a knight. All laughed at his ignorance, but Arthur kindly explained that he would have to earn the title by rising through the ranks, beginning as kitchen knave. The young Percival caused chaos wherever he went, but even though he tried people's patience, most looked upon him with affection. Percival matured and eventually received his knighthood. In the early days of his career, he happened upon a maimed man fishing from a boat. Unknown to Percival, this man was the Fisher King, who offered the young knight lodging in his nearby castle. Although grateful for the invitation, Percival was surprised and puzzled. He had been told there were no castles for many miles. While in the Grail Castle, Percival was witness to the mysterious procession of the Grail. The young lodger remained silent as it passed before him and into an adjoining chamber. It was a strange and wonderful sight, like nothing he had ever seen. Thinking himself polite, Percival restrained himself from asking any questions concerning the Grail. This was a very unfortunate circumstance, for had he asked, thereby showing interest and concern, both the Fisher King and his wasting lands would have been healed. Having failed this test, Percival awoke the next morning to find himself alone in the mysterious castle. Quite baffled, Percival mounted his horse and left the castle. As he neared the end of the drawbridge, however, it began to close, seemingly of its own accord. Horse and rider were forced to jump to reach the bank. Percival would later realize his grave mistake in failing to ask the question and would spend many years trying to find the otherworldly castle of the Grail. Percival eventually became one of Arthur's greatest knights. Percival, Galahad, and Bors made up what is known as the Three Elect, the three who would achieve the Holy Grail. On his second visit to the castle, Percival and his companions were successful. Galahad healed the wounded king, lifting the curse over the land. In early accounts, Percival is the hero, as Galahad is a later literary addition to the story. Having looked deep into the mystery of the Grail, Galahad no longer wished to live and died amidst great beauty. The Grail King instructed Bors to carry the news to the world, dubbing him the messenger. He then appointed Percival his replacement as Grail Guardian, dubbing him the Keeper of the High Word. So, this beautiful ending about, quote-unquote, achieving the Grail obviously is about fully waking up and fully coming in to this dance we do with the heart's desires, the mental discipline, and achieving and experiencing our own divinity as the layers of human belief and distortion fall away. We experience ourselves in all of our power, in all of our beauty, in all of our love. And it is absolutely your birthright, and it is absolutely possible. It is my birthright. It is so possible. And as we've discovered in our Grail series, looking at how we define love, looking at how we can embrace acceptance more broadly, as we've talked about today. These are great helpers along the way as we keep discovering greater and greater experiential moments of I am, or the Grail. So with that, I have much more to say in December, but I want to conclude and thank you for being part of this series, because it has certainly blessed me. And until next time, take good care. Hi, everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lorigreen.net.